Hello and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to our podcast on CelticUnderground.net. I'm Harry Brady and this week is a podcast by St Anthony.
Bring me sunshine in your smile. Bring me laughter.
Well, you'll all by now know some of the exciting things that are happening in May with the Celtic FC Foundation. There is the zip slide, which is at the beginning of May, so you can go online and register for that now. Get your sponsorship to slide down at Celtic Park. And there is the Lubo v Henrik charity match, which is happening shortly after we win the treble, so you can buy tickets now for that. There is also a Celtic FC Foundation event in London for the Lisbon Lions. Very exciting. Not in my pocket range, but lots of people down in London will be able to go along to that. And I know and I am sure there are other events that will coincide miraculously around the 25th of May. Anyway, that's the foundation stuff out of the way. This week we have a podcast with St Anthony and a special guest. And no, it is not a former player. I'm not going to give too much away because I'll just let St Anthony do the introductions. But Guy's a big Celtic fan. Guy's somebody you'll probably, if you're in Scotland anyway, you'll probably recognise off the television. And it's not Sean. Anyway, I'll leave St Anthony to do the introductions. This guy used to sit behind me in the North Stand. Not sure if he still does. Not seen him for a while. But big Celtic fan. Big guy off the telly. Excellent interview with St Anthony. And I'll leave it to him.
Today I'm joined by one of the most recognised personalities in Scottish television, Bernard Ponsonby. Bernard is renowned for his political commentary and interviewing skills on STV's political programmes and is known to be a big Celtic fan. Welcome, Bernard.
Thanks very much.
We always start with the same question for all the guests. What was your first Celtic game and who was your first Celtic hero?
I knew you were going to ask this, and the answer is that I can't actually remember my first game, but it would have been around about 1970, because I would have been seven when I was first taken. So I can't remember precisely the first game, but of course it was all before league reconstruction, which came in 1975, and I can recall going to Celtic Park with my father, lifted over the turnstile, and seeing teams like Clyde and Dunfermline and East Fife, who were then all in the old First Division. So I can't remember the precise game, but it would have been 1970, and my first cup final would have been 71, but we won't go into that. It was, because my father said, we're going to see Celtic win the cup today. At that time, we were staying in Castlemilk, and so it was quite a short journey to Hampden. And people may well remember that on Grandstand, which started on a Saturday lunchtime, the then presenter of Football Focus was a guy called Sam Leach. And Sam Leach said, in Scotland, it's League Cup final day, mm-hmm. where Celtic play Partick Thistle, who have no chance. Of course, there were four eruptions in the first half, because Thistle scored four times. And in fact, my second cup final wasn't much better either. It was the League Cup final in 73, which was probably the wettest I've ever been in a ground. I think the attendance was only about 27,000, and Gordon Wallace scored for Dundee, and Tommy Gemmell held aloft the League Cup. So the first time I actually saw Celtic win a cup was Scottish Cup final in 74, which was 3-0 against Dundee United.
So who would your first hero have been as a boy then?
Well, in 1975, I was the Celtic boy. So I suppose that the first player that would have registered would have been Danny McGrain. But of course, back there in the early 70s, I mean, Jimmy Johnson would have been the entertainer in the team. And of course, Kenny Dalglish had come through. And by the time I was the Celtic boy in 75. Almost invariably, everybody who was asked outside Celtic Park if they wanted to be the Celtic boy, who was their favourite player? I mean, nine times out of ten in those days, it was actually Kenny Dalglish. But I can remember, and I've still got the autograph book somewhere, or my mother will have it at the bottom of a drawer, standing outside the ground at Celtic Park. And in those days, everybody just walked up. Mm-hmm. I mean, footballers weren't cocooned in those days, and getting Jimmy Johnson's signature, Bobby Lennox, Billy McNeil, George Connolly, Danny McGrain, Kenny Dalglish. And in that sense, back then, there was maybe a greater affinity between supporters and players, because they weren't as aloof as they are now.
They were touchable.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you just stood there. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I remember with my father, he would name everybody coming up Kerrydale Street. You would even try and spot the odd celeb Celtic supporter, and you used to always see Joe Beltrami, the lawyer, going in, because he sat in the south stand.
Jimmy Reid's a guy I remember as a kid. I remember my dad pointing Jimmy Reid out, because he was a personality of the period, you know, with the sitting and stuff like that.
I don't know that Jimmy Reid was a Celtic man.
He was, yeah.
Well, I did see Jimmy Reid in Seville. Mm-hmm. I can't remember who he was with, but he had a large glass of brandy and a cigar. But of course, back then, he was a member of the Communist Party, and members of the Communist Party were very, very careful not to do anything which was too green or too orange, because they didn't want anything which would interrupt the unity of the working class. And I can remember Jimmy Reid on a documentary that was produced in 1974 by, it's on YouTube, and
is
it's fascinating. I think it was a German production company. Cliff Hanley is also on this documentary. And again, Jimmy Reid sort of bemoans what he sees as the tribalism of the old firm fixture. And he certainly didn't out himself in that programme as a Celtic supporter.
Now that's an interesting film, because it's very historical, almost in the fact that it shows you parts of Glasgow which was rapidly changing at the time. And the motorway was coming through the city, and so if anybody hasn't seen it, then it's well worth that.
It's well worth viewing also for the social history of the time, because there are certain comments which Mr. Waddle made in that documentary, which people will find interesting to say the least.
The other thing as well is the behaviour of the fans in the terrace is shown in graphic detail. You know, the guys drinking cans, bottles, fighting, arrests, police. So it's really it's an eye-opener for people who may not recall that particular year.
But that was, I remember, first going to European games, for example. I was at the semi-final in 72 against Inter Milan when Dixie skied it over the bar. The 74 semi-final against Atletico Madrid, and probably the one experience when I was in the ground where I thought, I'm actually not going to get out of here alive, was I think the quarter-final was against FC Basel, and it was 3-2 over there, 3-2 at Celtic Park, and Steve Murray got the winning goal in extra time after 108 minutes. And it gets back to this thing about the terraces. I mean, I was at the Rangers end of the ground that night, because we'd moved to Cambers Lang at that point, and that was the sort of closest terrace as you came in the London Road. And you will remember that there were various barriers, but in between the barriers, if you were stood there, you were just squashed. Mm-hmm. And the grounds in these days, European nights, were packed. And if there was a movement of people, you were caught up in it. And I would have been, 9, 10 at the time. And it was quite terrifying in a sense. You didn't think anything of it, because that's just what happened. And although I get nostalgic for some bits of the old Celtic Park, on things like that, were sort of health and safety issues, absolutely right that everything's moved on.
Yeah. I'm insanely jealous that you were a Celtic boy, because as a kid, I used to wonder how these special kids get their photos in the Celtic view with their favourite player. So It's kind of funny because that photograph has been done to death in Celtic websites. Mm. You know, because you obviously you're very young in it. You're just a young boy, and the guys are saying, "Guess who this is? It's Bernard Ponsonby, being the guy off the telly." Yeah. But so how did it come about? How did you become a Celtic?
Well, I can remember the game. It was a pre-season friendly against Derby County. Celtic won 1-0. It was also the debut that Johannes Edvaldsen made, because he'd been signed from FC Valor as the replacement for Billy McNeil, mm-hmm. who of course gave that famous interview to Alec Cameron on Scotsport where he announced his retirement after the 75 Cup final against Airdrie. And we were just basically approached outside the ground, because as I say, we used to stand there mm-hmm. and wait for autographs and spot famous faces and all the rest of it. And I was simply asked, "You want to be the Celtic boy?" And that was that day. And I think it was about 2 weeks after that when I met Danny McGrain. And as I said, most people used to choose, probably understandably, Kenny Dalglish. But I was very, in retrospect, pleased with my choice, because Danny, like Billy McNeil, like Bobby Lennox, like Tommy Burns, like Paul McStay, was essentially a one-club player. And I think, and I remember one of the home international championships that was used to always come at the end of the season, and the BBC had Jock Stein and Don Reavy as the panellists, I think, for a Scotland-England game. And at half-time, Reavy turned to Stein and said, "How much do you want for McGrain?" Stein said, "He's no for sale." And, I think in that sense that would Dalglish have got into a World 11? Debatable. Mm-hmm. Would McGrain have got into a World 11? Arguably, he would have.
Absolutely. And through the years, is there one particular game that you recall with fondness more than any others? Are a few games?
Well, sort of in recent times, the 2-1 game against Barcelona, obviously, on the anniversary. The 6-3 game back in, when was it, 2000, against Rangers. And I also really, really, really liked the 4-3 game in the Champions League against Juventus. Mm. And I think the first half in that game in particular, I thought, was Moravcic's best 45 minutes in a Celtic jersey.
Maybe some player, someone who's a wonderful player.
Now, Lubo who? As people in my profession used to say, Lubo who?
Well, there's a famous one about Hugh Keevans, his article saying, "Why don't you spend the money on John Spencer rather than a Slovakian has-been?"
So. Well, I think Hugh also, if you remember, it was before... It was before Wim Jansen was appointed, reliably informed us that Arthur Jones
right.
was going to be the manager.
Yeah, he was very crestfallen after that. He's really been the same since. So you're a busy man, and you're doing an important job. Does it sometimes mean you need to miss games because of the political arrangements or anything that's happened?
Yeah.
Does it get in the way?
It does. I'm probably like a lot of people. You want your football at 3 o'clock on a Saturday, and you don't want it any other time. Certainly don't want it at, this Sunday, just after midday. Mm. On a Sunday. But yeah, I mean, two of the three Champions League games I missed this season because of work commitments. I always get the ticket and make sure the ticket is used by somebody. But yeah, it does actually interfere. Most midweek games recently, we've had quite a run midweek games recently. Been fine for them.
Mm-hmm. So you were involved in politics from a young age, so what first attracted you to the politics scene?
I just sort of watched news and current affairs. I mean, I was always had a passion for news and current affairs and documentaries, and always just watched them, and eventually got into this line of work. I mean, I'm the third political editor in the history of STV. The first one was Jimmy Gordon, Lord Gordon, mm-hmm. who went off to found Radio Clyde. And of course, some of the best footage from Lisbon in 67 was a documentary that was made by Jimmy Gordon that the late Sir Robert Kelly had asked him to make. Because I remember saying to Jimmy Gordon, how did the political editor of STV get to make a documentary about Celtic? And he knew Robert Kelly very well. And what happened was that they were making a documentary about Celtic in the 66-67 season. And nobody, Jimmy Gordon didn't know at the time how the season was going to pan out. And it was just fortuitous that Celtic went all the way to the final. So they got all of this footage in Estoril, and then the footage at the game, and the footage in, on the way back. And Jimmy Gordon also, probably this is not so well known, had a pub with Jock Stein. I think they both owned the Lord Darnley in Shields at the time.
Oh yeah, but we're far
from here, aren't we? He got to do something in relating to Celtic, and very sadly, when Tommy Burns died, we put out a 25-minute. It wasn't a biographical program; it was just a tribute program. It was a bit sort of thrown together. But they'd asked me to write and produce it, and David Heyman came in to narrate it, and because he said to me, "Didn't know you were a Celtic supporter," I said, "I didn't know you were either." But David Heyman was one of those individuals, unlike me, he wasn't born into Celtic, didn't come from that kind of family. He made the conscious decision to actually support Celtic based upon the identity and values of the club, which is always something we should bear in mind.
I was speaking to Brian Olsen last week, who I know you'll know very well from the politics scene, and I was enchanted by his story about coming from Dunoon, not having any. His dad was a Celtic fan, obviously, but they didn't have the sort of the Catholic-y thing that most of us may have had in the city of Glasgow. And he said that he's never fails to be amazed that when you go to the wee places in the outlying areas, that there is an attraction to Celtic that isn't what you get within the city.
Yeah.
It's a sort of people support them mainly for the football, and almost the romantic notion of the beginning of the club, the charitable aims and that kind of thing.
That's absolutely true, because I had a producer here many, many, many years ago called Angus Peats, who was from Nottingham, and so spoke with an English accent. And one day he came in with a whole load of memorabilia, and including an LP, which must have been official club merchandising in the early to mid 60s, and the first song on it was the Celtic song from Bartholomew Dick, or to give him his stage name, Glenn Daly. The second one was Faith of Our Fathers, and the third one was The Dying Rebel. Now, this was official club merchandising in the mid 60s, when back then people tended not to bat an eyelid that kind of stuff, because it was all pre the outbreak of the troubles in Northern Ireland. And I said, what on earth are you doing with something like that? And he had explained to me that his father, Professor Dieter Peats, who the Jewish family who had come to the UK, had started watching Celtic because he liked the way that they played. And then when he started to research the history of the club and the identity, just became hooked on it. Mm. And here was an English guy who'd come up from Nottingham, studied at Edinburgh University, ended up as a producer at STV as a Celtic supporter. So, I mean, it does indicate that there is something about the identity and traditions of the club that people really do relate to. Mm. They really do, which is why certainly the fan base now, given that Glasgow's a much changed city, is, you just have to look at it, is different from when you and I were growing up.
I need to ask, if Jimmy Gordon was the first and you were the third, who was the second?
The second one was a guy, Colin Mackay.
I remember Colin.
Colin Mackay had absolutely no interest in football whatsoever.
Is that his son that's in?
No, it's not.
Because
there's two Colin Mackays. There's old Colin and young Colin. Young Colin's currently.
That's quite a coincidence.
And exactly the same spelling as well. Colin Mackay had no interest in football whatsoever. Mm-hmm. In fact, Probably if he was ever sent to report on it, he'd get the score.
What about
wrong.
The rest of the guys in STV then? Is it true John Mackay's a Rangers fan?
Ah, no, you're right. You're asking me to spill the beans.
Blue tie Mackay.
The secrets, I dare not go there. Let's just say in the newsroom there's a healthy sprinkling. not of blue noses, I should say.
So we're talking there about you moved into the politics scene. Now, I'm Govan, born and bred, and I well remember the by-election of November 1988, when a certain Lib Dem candidate was a young Bernard Ponsonby. And that was your good self. So how did it come out? You must have been a very young man at that time, because you and I are roughly the same age.
Yeah, I was in...
You must have been mid-20s.
Yeah, 24, 25 at that time, and... I mean, it's one of these elections that's gone into sort of political folklore, partly because the result was unexpected at the time. Jim Sillars managed to get a swing of 33%. And the aforementioned Brian Wilson was actually the minder for the Labour candidate in that by-election.
Bob Gillespie?
Bob Gillespie was the Labour candidate. Bob's actually... still around. You see him around.
I only discovered the other day that Bob Gillespie is Bobby
Correct.
Gillespie's father.
Correct.
Of Primal Screen.
That,
and
the very man. Yeah.
Jesus and Mary Chain.
Yes.
So
yes.
Every day's a learning day, right?
Every day's a learning day. And I mean, Bob was, when Bob lost it, the Labour Party changed the way it selected candidates for by-elections on the back of it. There was a programme recorded at STV where, you know, Bob wasn't particularly great. And, of course, Jim Sillars was, and still is, a very formidable figure. And it was just...
How did the by-election come about? Bruce Millan resigned, did he?
Bruce Millan was made a European Commissioner.
That's
and
right.
What happened was that he... The announcement of him being made a commissioner was made, I think from memory, in June of 88. And if the Labour Party were wise, he would have resigned the seat straight away and they would have held a snap by-election. So what actually happened was that everybody knew there would have been a by-election from June of 1988, but the writ for the by-election wasn't moved until after Parliament had reconvened. And polling day was the 10th of November. So the SNP had months to plan for this. They'd selected Jim Sillars, who, as I say, was formidable. And it also coincided at the time when the poll tax was being introduced. And Jim Sillars actually stood in the by-election as SNP, pay no poll tax. That's what was on the ballot paper. And... he won it with this large swing, largely, I think, on the back of the anger about the introduction of the poll tax, which, of course, was introduced in Scotland before it was introduced in England. And at the time, in the immediate aftermath of the election, people were sort of foaming at the mouth to say, what does this mean? Is this going to mean a fundamental realignment in politics? But, of course... 7 or 8 months later, you had a by-election in Glasgow Central, which Jim Sillars' protege Alec Neil fought, and Labour eventually held on to that
Watson,
quite comfortably. Mike Watson.
Mike Watson. Mike Watson.
The ex-Dundee United director.
That's right. Now, the thing I remember about that, is just to digress slightly, into politics was, I remember going for a newspaper one night, because in those days there was no social media and stuff like that, and you were relying more on the traditional media. And Jim Sillars actually got an open backed lorry and parked it at the corner of Ending Governor Morris. It's a busy corner, Elder Park Street and Crossing Road. And he'd a loudhailer and he just started speaking. And within, I would say, about 5 minutes of me going in for a paper and coming out again, there was about 25 people around him listening to it. And it was old fashioned politics, old soapbox politics.
Well, that's right, because there were public meetings which were being held in the constituency. Candidates' debates, actually before the writ technically was moved to fix the date for the 10th of November. I think in all there were 13 public meetings that I recall. The first one was at Ibrox Library, and the last one, which I think from memory was two nights before polling, was at Our Lady in St George in Penny Lee.
Yeah.
And that was the time when you could almost sense that there was an upset on the cards. It was also, I think, the time where he palpably went into verbal overdrive, I recall. These meetings, these public meetings, the first one that was covered by television was in the Pierce Institute. But as I say, there was one at St. Gerard's Secondary as well. I remember that one because Jim started his speech that day, and this was a meeting in front of fifth formers, you know, the senior, senior pupils, and he started it by saying, "Horns up, all them that think they're working class." And all the kids were looking at one another and they went, nobody put their hand up, which is really embarrassing from his point of view. And there was this chortling sound from a figure on the front row on the other side of the hall. And it was the figure of the late Alan Watkins, who'd come up to cover this for the Observer newspaper. He was a columnist for the, and I think latterly did cricket for the Independent. And he was a bit giggly at the way this had slightly backfired on Jim.
And you were the first guy to stand, in a historical political note, you were the first Lib Dem candidate for a by-election after the merger of the Lib Liberals and the Social Democrats.
Yeah, that's right.
And what was your experience of it at the time? Because as I said, I recall that vividly.
I mean, I didn't have much experience because I wasn't really a major player. It was really fought out between Bob Gillespie and Jim Sillars. Who are old enough to remember always want to talk about it, and as I say, it's gone into sort of political folklore because it was such a shock at the time. But my memory of it is quite distinct, that for most of the time actually it was a pretty pedestrian by-election and actually quite boring, and I subsequently went on and covered many of these things in my career, and certainly ones that I covered were a lot more exciting than Govan. But because the result was so dramatic, people then, I think, ascribe a drama to it, which wasn't really my recollection of it at the time.
Because I come back for Werder Bremen. Celtic played Werder Bremen in the European Cup, and I come back the Thursday morning, and that was election day, just in time to vote. I remember that, going to vote at the time, and people, you know, as you said, there was something in the air that people sort of detected that they could be.
You could detect it the weekend before, and there was this famous STV programme, which was broadcast on the Monday night. And STV used to use System 3 as pollsters. And the System 3 poll, it was taken just before the weekend, before the poll, had Labour on 52 and the SNP on 33. With a third undecided. Now, when that poll was taken, that was probably about right. But over the course of the last weekend, you could detect in the constituency that there was a shift. And then what happened was that in the STV debate, Labour had a pretty disastrous performance. And although only a certain number of people in Govan would have heard about or had seen this debate, everybody by polling day had heard about it, and all the ingredients, the poll tax, a weak Labour campaign, were all there, and they swept Jim Sillars to victory.
Because I'm old enough to remember 73 when Margaret MacDonald won, and I remember obviously Margaret MacDonald married Jim Sillars.
And she beat Harry the Barber.
Was that Harry Selby?
Harry Selby beat Harry the Barber in the by-election. But of course, she was one of the shortest serving members of Parliament. Because she won in November of 73.
Less than a year, is it?
Oh, she lost it in February 74.
Right. Yeah.
And then Harry Selby, there was various boundary changes, but Harry McMahon, the guy McMahon eventually represented it for Labour for a number of years.
Because I remember she came at your door one night and answered the door when I was a kid. And she didn't ask to speak to my mum, she asked to speak to my dad, and she said that because my mum had a family, was she okay? And it was the first time I ever heard the word creche, because she was ahead of the time, she would make sure that mother, appealing to female vote, and making sure that if there was somebody with a big family, that there was somebody to bring the kids in safety, so you could get to vote and come back again.
Because I mean, she was brought up in East Kilbride, When she married Jim, they moved to Edinburgh, and actually towards the end of her life, I mean, she was really, really big in the football, really passionate about Hibs, and was a regular at Easter Road, because Jim used to complain to me that he would be dragged along to Easter Road. And Jim, in fairness, I don't think was terribly interested in football. If he followed anyone, it would have been Ayr United, because of course he comes from Ayrshire originally and represented South Ayrshire in Parliament for Labour between 70 and 79. But he was always dragged along to Easter Road. And of course, one of Margot's daughters was married to one of the Proclaimers.
Never knew that. So what led to the career change to go into political broadcasting after having been...
I wasn't in politics for 2 minutes, really, as an activist. But on the back of Govan, a guy called David Scott, who used to be head of news and current affairs here, had approached me to say, we would like you to come and work for us. And probably in the next year, but before the formal offer came, I got a couple of phone calls from the BBC saying, would you come and work for us? And eventually what happened, I was a bit apprehensive because I had no experience as a journalist and I had absolutely no experience of broadcasting. But eventually what happened was that I freelanced for the BBC for about, I think, 14 months, and then I switched to the BBC, where I was recruited by John Brown, who was the then politics producer, who's also a season ticket holder at Celtic.
Good man.
Although his brother is a season ticket holder at Raith Rovers.
Now,
one Gordon Brown.
All right, that Gordon Brown. Now, you're well known and respected as STV's main political commentator and interviewer. And I was speaking to Brian Lawson last week, touching on politics, and we're saying, you've had the independence referendum, probably going to have a second one. You've had Brexit referendum, you've Donald Trump. Is this an interesting time to be involved in politics?
Well, it's a time when nobody knows really what's going on. And if any political journalist or commentator tells you that they can predict what's going to happen, given all that ferment that you've just alluded to, then just don't believe them. I've always thought, because I've followed politics for so long, that I had a reasonable handle on it and could see the way the wind was blowing. I wouldn't predict anything. I just wouldn't.
Mm-hmm. That's just the times we're living in.
Times we're living in.
Changing times.
Times we're living in.
So you've interviewed all the main UK political figures over the last 25 years or so. If you could go back in time to interview any politician from any era, who would you pick?
Probably Harold Wilson, because I've watched a lot of the historical interviews with Wilson, and he was curious because he answered questions quite directly. And his answers were never too long. I mean, I remember him. This was the European referendum in 75, where Robin Day was the big interviewer, the great inquisitor at the time, and Day was haranguing Wilson about the result of the referendum, and Wilson, who was very quick in his feet, very quick in his bum as well, when he was interviewing, said, you know, this referendum result will shape the destiny of this country for years to come. It'll be known well after people have forgotten who Harold Wilson was, and it might even be possible that they will have forgotten who Robin Day was. And Robin Day was completely crestfallen with the answer. Watching Wilson's interviews, I thought he's quite fascinating, so I would like to have interviewed him. I've also watched and have heard people who interviewed Enoch Powell, who said that he was completely and utterly ferocious in interviews, because if you asked a question which was based upon lazy supposition, he would then turn the thing and interview you if he thought in any sense you weren't up to it.
Mm. So, say that you're a film buff, is that true?
Yeah, I go to quite a lot of films, yeah.
Yeah, because I was talking to...
I know that I can tell from these questions, you've taken this from Wikipedia and I don't know who, I don't know who tampers with these kind of entries, but yeah, I do go to quite a lot of cinema.
There's actually a guy in my work, and he's at one of these tickets that he gets into Cineworld quite
and
he says he sees you fairly often.
Yes.
So it's not just lazy research. But no, again, just a question, one film, what would you pick?
Oh, 12 Angry Men, Henry Fonda, the film about the open and shut case, and Fonda wears them all down one by one with bludgeoning logic and righteousness in his sight.
We'll come back on the Celtic then. So we're very successful at the moment now under Brendan, and the financial figures have just come out, which are absolutely tremendous considering the small pond that we're in compared to the big ocean that the other teams are swimming in. So how much have you enjoyed it this season?
I've really enjoyed it this season. The interesting thing is that under Ronnie, and I suppose everybody's really, really sorry that it didn't work out for him, because he was palpably a very decent guy. And you always want every Celtic manager to do well, but it never worked out. What's obvious is that players who were... I mean, I just was not sold on Armstrong at all last season. I mean, he's completely changed.
Rogic?
Rogic, yeah, absolutely. Mm. But particularly Armstrong, he seems to be physically stronger. He seems to be physically fitter. His cross balls and shooting last year were deplorable. Mm. That clearly... has got better and better and better. His carrying of the ball is better. His vision is better. Forrest has had a new lease of life. Boyata, obviously, and the other centre back who wasn't getting a sniff. Sviatchenko, I wasn't sold on last year either. Mm-hmm. Thought it was too slow, too ponderous. He's really started to read the game, has a little bit of aerial threat. And of course, because Armstrong and Dembele and Griffiths and Rogic have been out, he's managed to sort of change the system, even playing Patrick Roberts last week as a centre forward. He seems to be able to change it, and yet the rhythm is still there, and it's fantastic to watch. Long may it continue. I thought last week's midweek game against Aberdeen was quite fascinating on the one level. They were very well organised, a bit like St Johnstone the week before, and he just had to get them to up the tempo, because I think when Celtic play at a really high tempo, if the other team has to try and match it, the team with the greater technical ability always wins out. And so I'm hoping on, I think it's the 10th of March, that they just absolutely go for it. Because the higher the tempo, teams are drawn into making mistakes. And if you don't have technical players, skillful players will always run through you. And I think that... I've heard various managers say go toe-to-toe. Cathro's used the term. McInnes has used the term. When they've tried to go toe-to-toe, we've just walked over the top of them.
Yeah, I think Scott Brown's another guy who deserves credit this season, because the last couple of seasons, mainly due to injuries probably, he hasn't performed to the level that we know he can, but this season he's been absolutely immense.
But I think, I'm not sure I agree with that. I mean, I know what you're saying, but if you've got he's sometimes in the centre of the midfield, sometimes he's back playing a sweeper role, sometimes he's charged. I mean, he's got a great engine. This season he's got players around him who are also playing, so he perhaps is not needing to cover the same amount of ground they had to in the last couple of seasons, where there were people round about him, where he was having to try and make up for their slack performances as well. But I mean, I know that people say he's got a new lease of life. I mean, I think he's always given 100%, always given 100%. And, he has to be first on the team sheet, because when the going gets tough, or in European games, when you just don't have as much of the ball, you need somebody in the park that can organise players, and he's a bit like Lennon in that respect. Mm-hmm. You know, he pops up and is always the last man to get the last tackle and then to have the reorganisation.
Now, the last 20 years or so, we were spoiled because we've had players like Decanio and Larsson, Maravchik, Nakamura, wonderful, technically gifted players who lifted the supporters week after week with their performances. But I really think that Scott Sinclair has got the potential to be like a Celtic great. Mm. Because when you see him playing, he is so fast, his feet are so fast, he moves all over the park, he's almost impossible to pin down.
Yeah, I mean, and of course, again, it's this thing about when they play at a high tempo, his feet are so quick. Roberts is a very, very quick feet. Dembele the other week, when he was playing, I think it was against St Johnstone, nothing was coming off for him. But again, he was trying a lot of trickery to try and sort of get round defenders. But yeah, I mean, Sinclair's, it's the fact that he can play as an out-and-out winger. It's a fact he can go through the middle. It's the fact that, you know, you've got options with Sinclair, and certainly if you read the forums and fan websites from other teams, actually the player that seems to come up more often than not is Sinclair. You know, they'll say, we need to shut down Sinclair. If we don't shut down Sinclair, we ain't going to win. It's not Dembele that they're talking about, it's Sinclair.
There is that fear factor there, because you know yourself, if you see Celtic playing against a team and they've got an exceptional player, he's the guy that the fans tend to talk about. But there's been comparisons made between the Celtic side and the Martin O'Neill side, and I think it bears comparison. They're both going in long unbeaten runs, both going for the treble, both got exceptional players. Can you see the logic in that?
Absolutely, but I mean, with the O'Neill teams, you know, Lennon was signed for £5.5 million.
A lot of money.
Sutton was signed for £6 million. Mm-hmm. Hartson was signed for £6 million. To that extent, we're in a different model. I mean, Banky was again saying yesterday in his statement, which accompanied the fantastic results, that the model that we have for signing players ain't going to change, and it's the right model. It is absolutely the right model. So if Brendan can go beyond the group stages in the Champions League, and you know, we should never take it for granted that we're always going to get there, but if he could take us on a run either in the Europa League all the way to the final or to the last 16, of course that would absolutely stand comparison. But everything, I think, always has to be looked through the prism of what else is happening in the game in Scotland. And I mean, O'Neill's teams certainly had a much stronger Rangers team to beat. Hearts were a much stronger proposition back then as well. Not Aberdeen, but Hearts. So, I mean, it's just, it's been good and it's been great. And you hope it goes all the way to the end of the season unbeaten. And you can hope that there'll be signings in the summer, which will mean it'll be even better in Europe next season. But I'm realistic. I'm one of these people who are completely and utterly realistic. Just as there's an expectation we'll always win the league in Scotland, and if you're financially as far ahead as we are, that's an expectation that is absolutely right to have. When you go on and play with the superpowers, you have to be realistic. But, you know, some Portuguese teams who play in small leagues with not big financial bases, not so much the Dutch now. I mean, not so much the Dutch now, but the Portuguese teams still seem to punch above their weight. So it's a case of, can he sign some good players, some good finds? Can he keep the nucleus of the side together for two or three seasons to give us a run at it? And can the players that he have continue to improve? Because some of the players this season to last are night and day. If that improvement continues, why shouldn't we have a run? But we always should be realistic.
again, to touch on Brian Wilson, he was saying that the difficulty that we have is, and this is felt at the directorial level as well, that the four hardest games of the season come at the beginning. And he says that can make or break the season. He says last couple of seasons, wee bit of bad luck, and we didn't make it, therefore you get into August, September and a downer. He says, but this season we get the lift again through, and you know, it was amazing how the team just moved on from that. You know, the lift they got from beating the Israeli team to get through to the Champions
League. Yeah, I mean, we know the coefficient, so we know we're going to have to do it all over again. Mm. And I think I'm right in saying that those who qualify for the Europa League are going to play their first games at the end of June. Mm. You know, we're going to have to go through it again, but we're in a much better position this year compared to last. I mean, I think we should be confident that we'll make the group stage, and it would be fantastic to get out of the group. But I mean, I remember actually I was doing a live on the night of the Champions League draw. Jeremy Corbyn was speaking at the exhibition centre, and I had the earpiece in. The draw was made, I think, at 5 o'clock UK time, and I'm sitting with the earpiece and I'm shouting to the gallery, keep me up to date with
the draw.
And so when I heard Barcelona, Manchester City and München Gladbach, I just knew. We were going. And of course there were one or two groups that I think we might have had a chance of getting out of. It was just a really, really tough group.
I mean, you see how poor Leicester have fared in the English League, and they flew through their group, and I saw a couple of Leicester games, but for that level, it was desperately poor stuff.
Yeah.
I think it was Bruges, and I can't even remember the other team.
But I think you can, there's every year in the Champions League, you can look at a team that does well in the Champions League, and they're absolutely nowhere in their domestic league.
Yeah.
You know, some teams seem to be able to lift it, but a kind of draw would have been better. But you know, at the end of the day, barring the sort of the disaster in the Nou Camp, it competed well, and particularly in Gladbach.
Yeah, we probably should have won it and
had a chance of winning it.
A couple of chances later on. Yeah.
I mean, I think in these European games, it's about keeping your shape. It's not about teams that are more technically gifted running over the top of you. And again, in Europe, you can see he plays it slightly differently because he has to play it slightly differently. You can see what he's doing. And you know, we're always in with a shout at home when you know, the atmosphere is always as big and fantastic.
So in closing then, what's the hopes for the season? And it must be the treble. If the league's in a bag, the League Cup's already there, then go for broke and go for the treble.
Go for the treble, and
which hasn't been done very often for Celtic managers, has to be said.
No. I mean, Anil was the first from Steen. Mm-hmm. The League Cup's always a bit of a bogey. I mean, I had a bad feeling actually about the League Cup final against Aberdeen, partly because I saw Partick Thistle, I saw Dundee, and the League Cup final before that, I saw that one trundle along the line. I was there actually with the late Paul McBride that day, the Lord Matthews, who's now one of the High Court judges, and so we lost that 1-2-1 that day. I think it's always been a bit of a bogey competition, so hopefully the treble, hopefully the reason that we didn't sign anyone in January apart from the player we signed is because the philosophy is simple: if it's not adding value, why would you bother? Let's wait to the summer and add value. There's a bit of a war chest there. We know we won't be spending 5 or 6 million, but he will know where he wants to go with this. And as the banners say, in Brendan we trust.
The League Cup final was a funny one because I was apprehensive as well, but you probably were at the game in 76 when Aberdeen beat Celtic 2-1.
In fact, I was, yes.
Well, that was the 40th anniversary, and Aberdeen were making a big thing about, you know, it's 40 years since then, and I thought, God, I remember that day, I couldn't get through that again. That was a sore one.
Yeah, I mean, I should admit, I was at that one as well. Mm. I think it was, what was it? Drew Jarvie and Davy Robb.
Correct. Funny how things
Swines.
Remember.
I remember Drew Jarvie when he played for Airdrie. I used to go to Broomfield. Didn't go to many away grounds. Fir Park and Broomfield were certainly two. And of course, the worst referee in the world, Mr. R.G. Davidson, brackets Airdrie.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Michael Kelly reckons that he was the worst referee ever.
There was a few in that era. There was Ian Foote and there was a guy called J.P.R. Gordon or J.R.P. Gordon. So they were equally bad, I have to say. So I've taken up enough of your time, and I'm really grateful for speaking to us. It's been very enjoyable. So all the best for the future and whatever projects that you take up.
No problem. Thank you very much, Stephen.
And we'll continue to watch you on the television with great fondness.
Hail, hail.
So I hope you enjoyed that podcast from St Anthony and Mr Ponsonby. There you go. Didn't see it before. I'll let you see it now. Anyway, enough of me. Let's see if we beat Inverness on Saturday and move one step closer to the title. And you never know who the managers of all the good teams are going to be. I certainly know that the Celtic coaching staff believe that the team who's most likely to offer the biggest challenge next season are the Jambos. They're very impressed by Ian Cathro. They're not impressed by McInnes, and don't know about their teams. Anyway, enough of me. This is me, Harry Brady, saying good night and God bless. Good night. Grow.